Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we inject weird and wonderful science directly into your genes. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, we hear part two of my interview with Nicola Schmidt and Peter Boacek explaining the politics of defending the Earth from asteroids and mining the asteroids without starting wars. But first up, here's reports of genetically edited babies. CRISPR, baby. He Zhongkui from Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen has controversially announced in a world's first that he has genetically engineered human embryos using CRISPR-Cas9 that were born as twin girls. The controversy is not just over the ethics of genetically engineering babies, but also that he broke the rules by publishing to YouTube and news service Associated Press without publishing to a peer-reviewed journal first. This means that nobody has seen his data, and nobody has confirmed that his huge claims are true. He reports on YouTube that his team engineered embryos for seven couples during fertility treatments, and so far, one pregnancy has resulted in birth. Michael Deem from Rice University in Houston said that he took part in the work, and he owns shares in the company that owns the patents. He made the announcement ahead of his presentation at the second International Summit on Human Genome Editing, which runs from the 27th of November until the 29th of November 2018, organised by the Royal Society. Ironically, one of the goals of the summit is to debate whether humans should be subject to gene editing that can be inherited or not. It's widely considered unethical and has been made illegal around the world. CRISPR is very precise. But there are sometimes genes other than the target genes unintentionally changed by the process, which could lead to health problems for the children and their descendants. The intention was to change a gene that makes people susceptible to infection by HIV, the AIDS virus. About 1% of people descended from Northern Europeans, particularly Swedes, naturally have a mutation of the CCR5 gene that appears to give people lifetime immunity to HIV when they have two copies of the mutated gene, and perhaps suffer less from the symptoms of HIV infection when they only have one copy of the gene. The CCR5 gene makes a protein receptor doorway that allows the HIV virus to enter a cell. The doorway is locked in people with the CCR5 mutation, so they can't be infected with HIV. In interviews with Associated Press and in his YouTube videos, He described the procedure. Of the couples who were recruited, all of them consisted of a man who suffers from an HIV infection and a woman who does not. They were hopeful that their children would be immune to HIV. First, the men's sperm was washed to separate it from the semen to ensure no HIV virus was present. A single sperm was placed into a single egg to create an embryo. Then, the gene editing tool CRISPR-Cas9 was used to edit the CCR5 gene to change it to a mutant version. When these embryos were 3 to 5 days old, a few cells were removed and checked for editing. Couples could choose whether to use edited or unedited embryos for pregnancy attempts. In all, 16 of 22 embryos were edited, and 11 embryos were used in 6 implant attempts before the twin pregnancy was achieved. He says that tests suggest that one twin has both copies of the intended altered gene, and the other twin has just one of the altered genes. This means that only one of the twins may be immune to the HIV virus. He claims that both girls are healthy with no off-target genes affected. Documents found by Associated Press indicate that his funding comes from the Shenzhen government. people with the CCR5 mutation may be immune to getting AIDS from HIV, as well as smallpox and cholera, but they face higher risks of becoming sick with other viruses such as West Nile virus and of dying from the flu. We may not know if the children will suffer complications from the procedure for decades. Her says he's contracted to regularly check the twins' health as they grow up. If Her's claims are true, there is a danger that by acting to make the first genetically engineered babies with this trade-off that does not cure an inherited disease, but only protects against a disease you may never catch anyway, he's risking harming the reputation of the entire field of gene therapy when it's barely started. By failing to release a peer-reviewed paper ahead of any announcements, he's sown doubt over whether he's really used CRISPR on embryos which have been brought to term in a successful pregnancy and born healthy, and opened himself up to accusations of fraud. However, he has promised to release his data at the conference this week, and that his data would go through a peer-reviewed preprint service before it goes to be published in a peer-reviewed journal sometime soon. Scientists and bioethicists around the world are outraged by the claims. His university claims they had no idea of the research he's been doing while he's been on research leave for the last few years. A Chinese online forum of a group of 122 biomedical scientists released a joint statement speaking against the experiments, for the risk of harm to humans and the harm to the reputation of Chinese scientists. CRISPR was first applied to human embryos in 2015, but those embryos were not capable of ever becoming babies. They weren't viable. Nonetheless, ethicists were in uproar over that achievement. Somebody somewhere is going to repeat that achievement with viable embryos and then implant them in a woman eventually, because that's not much harder than repeating the 2015 experiment. If his data is confirmed, Her Jonkwe may be the first person to achieve this. But even if he isn't, it's a small step for somebody to do this, if they too can circumvent the ethical checks that have prevented genetically engineered babies everywhere else. Would you engineer your baby to be more at risk of dying from the winter flu or West Nile virus from a summer mosquito bite in order to have immunity to HIV, which they're much less likely to be exposed to in their lifetime? What about their children and their children's children? Would you risk your child being affected by off-target mutations that could give them cancer or new inheritable diseases in order to give them lifelong immunity to AIDS? Was it ethical for her to choose parents where every father had AIDS, so the babies will be exposed to HIV every day of their childhood? Was it an amazingly useful coincidence for the girls to be born twins, or did her ask for a family history of twins in the application? We will only know the scientific answers after the research is published in a peer-reviewed paper, but the ethical questions are still up for debate. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. And podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com.
This is a story of the future, but not the very distant future. It is a story that might have taken place the day after tomorrow.
Beware the asteroids! Nicholas Schmidt and Peter Boacek have been researching how to save the Earth without starting a war. The dinosaurs were wiped out by asteroids that hit the Earth, and the same thing could happen to us. But the tools to deflect the asteroids could also be used as weapons. Could defending the Earth also give us the technology to mine the asteroids and to launch robot probes to the stars? Nicola Schmidt is a research fellow at the Institute of Political Studies at Charles University in Prague. Peter Bowacek is a research fellow at the Institute for International Relations, also at the Charles University in Prague. Nicola and Peter have written a book about an international planetary defence organisation with well-thought-through policies and laws to use the latest technology for the good of everyone. This is the final part of last week's interview. Nicola starts by explaining more detail about how the Planetary Defence Council would work.
The interesting part on the Planetary Council concept is that we believe that we are not creating something what is not existing around us. No? To some extent, these bodies are already existing and they are cooperating. International scientific institutions are working on international research projects. Nation states are investing into their space programs. And businesses are looking towards asteroids as a possible place for mining raw materials, as well as philanthropists willing to build a supermassive laser to propel nanoprobes to Proxima Centauri when it comes to Breakthrough Initiative. And what we are currently trying to work on, or what we are currently working on, is that we believe that the Planetary Council will never be possessing nuclear weapons, because no nuclear countries will let something what will be emerging from the bottom to hold or possess nuclear weapons. On the other hand, there would be no need for nuclear weapons. For example, when it comes to the asteroids, let's not talk about the comets now, but when it comes to the asteroids, we are not so far away to have almost perfect solar system situational awareness, meaning that we might have very quickly, maybe in 10 years or 15 years, depends on what the astronomers will be provided, technology what they would be provided. But the point of perfect observation is that as we currently have a situation that we know about 95% of all asteroids bigger than 1 kilometer, so those asteroids which are capable to cause global disaster, having the perfect observation on asteroids which are, bigger than 50 meters would completely rule out the idea of using nuclear weapons, which is finally what the astronomers can do without having dual-use technologies. And that's what we are currently working on, is we believe that there are kind of technologies that can have dual-use, but not necessarily dual-use from the national security perspective, but dual-use from the global security perspective and also for humankind flourishing potentials towards exploring solar system, but also to the near stars when it comes to the project Breakthrough Initiatives. And here we are organizing a workshop in Prague at the end of March next year, to which we are inviting the best scientists from around the world, which is also the reason why we are currently in Australia to meet some of them. And the idea is to develop so-called roadmap of needed research that would finally lead to a development of a super powerful laser, which would not be used as weapon, but which would be used as a means to propel nanoprobes to, other stars. But at the same time, it can be used to push asteroids, but at the same time, it might be used for pushing satellites to higher orbits now, which is an interest of European space agencies. So the point is not to develop technologies which might be considered as a concern to national security. The point is that it's necessary to develop these technologies in order to do many things in space, including deorbiting orbital debris, including servicing satellites, including scanning surfaces of other bodies, including Moon, etc., that we simply need to have a kind of body, like Planetary Council, that would lay down the regime, how we treat these technologies and how we deploy a deep confidence between all the stakeholders that the technology is not going to be used against their will.
And at the end of the day, if humanity is to expand its presence in the universe, we will need to develop much more powerful technology in many ways, and very likely a technology that has dual use, that could be very much misused by a single party if it's managed only by a single party. So that's one of the big important issues that we're trying to, argue in our perception. And just to expand a bit more about the perfect observation, even in a scenario where we are mapping all the asteroids and all the potentially hazardous objects in our solar system, that doesn't mean the threat is diminished. It can still mean that, some of the orbits are going to eventually, in some period, intersect the orbit of the planet, of the Earth, because the orbits are changing. And they, you have the so-called Yarkovsky effect that, you know, that can change the orbits. You know, the orbital dynamics are very fluid as well. So it wouldn't mean that any collision is not happening, but it would definitely give us much more time to act on it in some more different technology, like the laser technology or something less invasive, let's say, than nuclear technology. And just to mention this as well, at this point, what we are being told is that we need about 5.5 years to, you know, put together a nuclear asteroid deflection mission. And that's a pretty long time. We are not getting detections of these asteroids with always 5 years ahead of the time of their impact. So because the whole mission would need to include much more monitoring, much more observation. It would need to include reconnaissance missions to actually figure out what the asteroid is made of. Because just from observing from Earth, we actually cannot figure out what the whole composition of it is, what the whole mass is, what the porosity of the asteroid is. So it'd be a long, many years into development of this deflection method. So even a perfect observation wouldn't necessarily ensure that there's no threat to us. And that's the argument that we should not only aim for, you know, the absence of the threat, but mainly for ensuring that the whole process aims to some higher goods, that it's not a process that justifies exceptional politics and some, you know, undemocratic and exclusive process of decision making on the international level, but it aims to enable and establish an inclusive global cosmopolitan decision making process that aims not only to make the threat disappear, but to make humanity flourish with the incorporation of this technology into other civilian uses like interstellar travel, like safety on the orbit or asteroid mining.
I think it's necessary. There is no other option than to cooperate on the international level. The threat is inherently global, but behavior of one state on its own is not going to save humanity. It's going to cause international political turmoil. And that's what we finally found so interesting on planetary defense, that it has the potential to be the enabler of international cooperation. So to perceive it from this perspective, talking about planetary defense can help us to build these new political structures.
And it's especially important to consider the whole context of planetary defense and its decision-taking, because even a successful mission could have much more negative implications politically if it's taken unilaterally, if it's taken without international consensus, and if it enables some sort of a further destabilization. So in this context, it's very important to get this international cooperation straight. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't believe that it is possible to have effective and true understanding and perception of this, of global threats, in a system that is based on national politics as constituting factors in security perceptions.
I can just imagine, just quick scenario, you could have one country taking a lead in deflecting an asteroid or blowing up an asteroid, and only to have the debris rain down and cause havoc in other places. And then who's responsible and what are the consequences?
It's the deflecting nation, according to current international law, because it's going to be the deflecting nation which will launch, say, the technology to space, which is going to be used as a means for the deflection mission. But yeah, we have to perceive it differently. I mean, in scenarios which are exercised at the planetary defense conferences every second year, every 2 years, we usually see that deflection, which is not powerful enough, is not necessarily going to cause a disturbation of the asteroid, but it can push the asteroid a little bit that it falls to a different country. So imagine a situation that an asteroid is on the way to fall in the United States and they push it a little bit and it falls finally to Europe. This is a situation which says very clearly and shows us very clearly that we can't behave on our own, because deflecting the asteroid badly may very quickly lead to global war.
You've got a book and you've got research that was commissioned by the government, and there was a government policy about planetary defense as well.
Yes, we have been working on a book about planetary defense last 3 years. which is written by 24 experts throughout living all around the world, including some experts from NASA, including people like David Morrison, which was writing about planetary defense about 40 years ago. And probably given the book and given the expertise we gained during writing it, we have been also awarded with that grant in Czech Republic recently, which is not necessarily a grant coming from the government. We are still independent scientists who are delivering advice to governmental bodies, not necessarily directly the government, but to the Ministry of Transport, which is responsible for space policy in the Czech Republic. So the current objective of the project is to prepare a national planetary defense strategy, but also a strategy how to develop new policy related to asteroid mining, which is also a very sensitive topic because according to current international law, it's not clear whether mining asteroids is appropriation of other celestial bodies, which is according to Outer Space Treaty prohibited. But at the same time, everybody is fully aware of the fact that we are not going to move out of Earth without mining raw materials in space. So the current situation is that we would like to link planetary defense with asteroid mining because it's exactly linking the security politics with politics now, which is helping humankind flourish to space.
The research that we're conducting, it's a multidisciplinary research. So we are mainly focused on policy as political scientists, but we are obviously not the natural scientists. That's why we have astronomers, world-renowned astronomers in our team. We have also engineers, laser technologists, as well as economists to put all these things together to actually come up with some sensible and applicable policy recommendations. So it's a multidisciplinary research, which is, you know, very exciting about it. And it's mainly very beneficial to sort of find the way how we can put together all these different goals regarding the asteroids, because you have different perspectives, different uses that require different policy. You can have focusing on the asteroids and their scientific value, which obviously have much more different motivation. Asteroids are scientifically extremely valuable because they are sort of the remnants of the forming of planets. So they offer a lot of just very good insights. And that data is usually shared globally on the principle of benefit sharing that is based on the Outer Space Treaty. From the other perspective, you can look at it as a reason to plan to defend the planet, that we need to learn about them much more. Then you're encroaching in some sort of a defense sector and defense policy that requires a different setup and different institutions. But then also when you look at it from the business perspective, they obviously there's a much very big part of commercial exploitation that is also implying different policy requirements. You're probably going to have to deal with the benefit sharing principle in a different way than just sharing data, because that might be problematic for the prospecting company that wants to make profit out of it. But at the same time, you can create some sort of a new environment where the benefit sharing is made by providing services, by providing some other benefits that you gain from utilizing space resources to the rest of the humanity. So these are different perspectives that dealing with asteroids that we trying to combine together, and we really cannot figure out any other way how this can be handled than doing this, globally, doing this together, doing this honoring the Outer Space Treaty, honoring the benefit sharing principles and the principle of cooperation.
And what's the name of the book?
The book is named Planetary Defense, Global Collaboration of Saving Earth from Asteroids and Comets. It's going to be published by Springer.
And is there a website people can find your research on?
Yeah, the website is there, but we have to first fill it with some information because we are all the time traveling around the world and giving interviews and working on results which are needed by our government. But yes, it's planetary-defense.eu, which is going to be filled by information soon.
And the book is available on Springer as well as on Amazon.
Well, Nicola and Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
That was the final part of my interview with Nicola Schmidt from the Institute of Political Studies and Peter Bowacek from the Institute for International Relations at Charles University in Prague about political structures to defend the Earth from asteroids and comets so we don't join the dinosaurs in extinction. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Would you like to hear your voice on radio? Record a voice memo on your phone or use the voicemail tab on the website. We need more people contributing stories to Diffusion. Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please do send me an email with a question I can answer on the show. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter @IanWolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod on incompetech.com. Sound and fact-checking by Charles Willock. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and my local station, 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.